hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today for our first podcast of the new year by Harriet Russell. How are you doing, Harriet?
Good, thanks, John.
Excellent. Did you have a nice break?
I did.
Break? Did we have a break?
I was going to say it flew by, but
it did. And we've been very busy with several issues that we put out over the holiday.
Editorial deadlines are my best friend at Christmas.
Absolutely. We're going to talk about retail today.
Yeah.
I know we often talk about retail, but it's kind of an important sector, and especially so at this time of year.
Yeah, I mean, probably from November through to the end of January is probably the most crucial months. An awful lot of profit gets delivered in those sort of few weeks. So it is important. And also, you know, retail as a sector is very indicative of what's going on in the general economy, which is what dominates the headlines at the moment. So it's a good one to look at.
So we're not sorry for talking about retail today. And Simon Thompson, how are you doing, Simon?
I'm doing well. A bit husky voice, but I'm doing very well, John.
And did you have a good Christmas and New Year?
Fantastic holiday. South of Valencia.
Oh, lovely.
19 degrees, sunny.
Yeah, all right, don't rub it in. and we are going to talk actually about the general economy, because that's how you've opened your first column of the new year.
It is.
Is it your first column? No, your second column.
Second column. I had one. I filed whilst I was overseas, and actually whilst I was flying back, something really majorly important happened in the States with the Federal Reserve, which is the piece in this column.
Okay. Well, we might as well start with that, because I guess that provides the backdrop for everything else that we're going to talk about in the rest of this podcast. So what has happened in the US, and what are the implications for the market in 2019?
Well, the US stock market had its worst December since the 1930s crash, and at one point the S&P 500 was down 15%, and people had noted that the 10-year yield curve in the States was as flat as a pancake, had inverted at low maturity yields. And, you know, in the past, this has been a great indicator of recession. And if basically the US goes into recession, that's bad news for everyone. What has changed materially in the last 2 weeks is that Jay Powell, the Federal Reserve, so the central bank chairman, came out with a statement that said the market's reaction was well ahead of the data. And I would point out that the US jobs figures on Friday last week were just absolutely amazing. They were good. But also the US Federal Reserve, which has been raising interest rates at a fair pace over the last couple of years, would now take a patient approach to monetary policy tightening. Well, that's worth noting, because the futures yield curve was actually at complete odds with what the central bank was predicting. The central bank was predicting 2 rate rises in the US this year. And previously, Mr. Powell, at the start of December, had said that the monetary tightening, so the withdrawal of quantitative easing, which was $50 billion a month, that's about 40 billion sterling a month of QE, was actually drained out of the system. That he said that was on autopilot at the start of December. Well, if the central bank is going to be patient, 2 things are going to happen. One, forget about 2 interest rate rises in the States this year. But secondly, the draining of liquidity out of the US monetary system is going to stop. And the clear implication of that is massive. The first thing is that the US dollar, which has been relatively strong, will start to weaken. If you take away the prop for the dollar, which is a draining of liquidity out of the system, plus higher interest rates, so you've got higher interest rate differentials compared with other currencies. So you're going to have a weaker dollar. But secondly, you've got a lot of borrowing overseas. So this is the offshore dollar borrowing market. Mm-hmm. There's $12.8 trillion, not billion, trillion dollars worth of borrowing outstanding, most of which, this is outside the US, by the way, most of which is actually not at fixed rate interest rates. So it's actually priced off the current Fed rate's interest rate. Now, if that interest rate isn't going to rise any further than it has done, that's going to give a liquidity boost to a whole range of markets. So some of the emerging markets that you've seen massive sell-offs in over the last 3-4 months could actually start to reverse. My take on it is, not only is it a positive for equity markets, you've seen the US equity markets and the European stock markets rally quite strongly since the start of this year, but if the US dollar is going to weaken, that has massive implications for the commodity complex, be it oil, energy, precious metal prices. These are all priced in dollars. So weakening of the US dollar is actually positive for those. And I've got a number of companies that are exposed to a weakening dollar.
Mm. I mean, it is quite interesting. You could potentially argue that, I mean, you said it's at odds with what the yield curve is telling us, what the Fed is saying, although you could argue they're responding to what the yield curve is telling them.
Well, the fact that the yield curve was starting to invert was telling you economically there are tough times ahead, if not recession.
And therefore, if there are tough times ahead, you don't want to be tightening monetary policy and raising interest rates in the face of that.
No, absolutely not. The futures market for the interest rate market for US was actually not implying two rate rises in 2019, which is what the Fed's guidance was at its last meeting.
So this is potentially good news for the stock market, but it's a liquidity-driven boost potentially. But the recession risk has not gone away. And there are lots of signs that we talked about earlier that actually there are mounting pressures in the global economy.
I don't disagree with that whatsoever. The point I would make is that it's one of the reasons that we had one of the longest bull markets in history. The US market peaked out the first week of October. The UK market peaked out in the summer in early June. But one of the reasons it lasted for the best part of a decade was the boost it got from QE, from this liquidity pool of cheap money that was sloshing around the system. And as soon as you start draining away that liquidity pool, you're actually reversing the effects of QE. And even the former chairman of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, came out publicly and basically said that one of the purposes of QE was a wealth effect to make people feel wealthier. And one effect of that was through higher equity prices. You've seen asset classes across the board, be it property, actually soar over the last decade. My point is that if the US Central Bank has belatedly realized that markets outside the US can't take any more strain from this withdrawal of liquidity, then it's going to address its monetary policy accordingly. And the hit that those markets have been taking by tighter liquidity conditions could actually start to reverse.
I guess the big question is, so this would suggest we may see markets rise for a while. How long can they rise in the face of the pressures that clearly exist out there? I mean, we've had some very bad news from China on car sales. We've had some very related bad news from Germany on industrial production. There's some pretty hideous figures from the UK's own car industry. Retail was not great this Christmas. There is clearly, the wealth effect is clearly dissipating. How long could markets sort of fly in the face of this?
There's two ways of looking at this, and I'm not sitting on the fence. People that think that the sell-off that we saw in the autumn and some in the US, but also from the summer highs in the UK, was actually the start of a long bear market. So the first stage, the sell-off, 15-20% drop in equity prices, you'd then expect a bounce-back rally,
might be what we're seeing now.
Yeah, absolutely. So the bears in the camp that have basically said, well, actually, the economic conditions are deteriorating, the earnings cycle has turned, and stock prices are too high, so the ratings are too high, so this is time to get out. We'll say use this rally to actually take money off the table from some of your positions. The bulls, on the other hand, will say if liquidity conditions are actually getting better, we've actually hit a point that they couldn't get any worse, that this will actually fuel a longer rally, which could be the last hurrah for the bull market that started in 2009. Now, only time will tell which of those camps is right. And I'm not sitting on the fence, but I'm saying that I expect quite a strong rally the first quarter of this year to happen if the Federal Reserve holds to the words of Jay Powell, which he made that speech last Friday, and is patient and basically holds off any more tightening.
I guess the big question then is, what do we do as stock pickers? Now, you've had a pretty good year on bargain shares.
I had a pretty good year in relation to the AIM market. The AIM market was down about 15% since February last year, which is horrendous. Using today's figures, the portfolio of 10 stocks I selected is roughly up about 14%. So it's outperformed quite strongly against AIM, where I picked the stocks from. I'm going to adjust my investment stock picking strategy for these market conditions. So I'm for this year's portfolio, I'm looking at incredibly lowly rated stocks where recessionary risk is already fully embedded in the price. I find stocks on 5-6 times earnings with decent balance sheets, so there's no financial strains on the balance sheets to justify those ratings. So basically, some of these companies, or the market at least, is predicting that, you know, the UK is going to have some shocking recession and their earnings are going to collapse. I'm going to take a contrarian view to that, and I've got a margin of safety, because if I'm buying stocks in 5-6 times earnings, and I point out the UK market is the lowest rated market in the world at the moment, I've got no problem at all actually finding stocks in single digit earnings multiples with cash in the bank or very low gearing, because the UK market's been hated. But my point is that the risk premium embedded in valuations at the moment is so high because the confluence of factors, be it Brexit, be it, as you said, the numbers that you're seeing coming out of Europe, so industrial production in Germany is in effect in recession, Italy's in recession. So what I'm saying is that if I can actually find stocks where the risk premium is ridiculously high, any positive news will actually filter in to an unwinding of the risk embedded in those stock prices.
It's interesting you say that, but that's in fact the theme of the cover feature this week, Down But Not Out. You know, shares that have taken an absolute drubbing, mainly because they're on the UK market, but as much as anything else. I mean, there were some horrors in there, which we may talk about when we get onto retail. But yeah, that the idea there is companies that have taken an absolute battering, the sentiment may be misplaced. The degree of negativity towards them may be overdone.
I'm putting together a portfolio of 10 small cap stocks, mostly listed in the AIM market. And if I'm right, and the whole point about the bargain shares is you're taking a contrarian view anyway, that the shares are cheap for a reason. And it's actually ascertaining if there's a catalyst to reverse the low ratings of the stocks. And I've gone through the whole of the AIM market, 947 stocks. I've gone through the FTSE fledgling index, the FTSE small cap index, to actually handpick 10 companies that I believe offer potential to outperform any market, be it rising market or falling market, because of that risk premium that's already embedded in those share prices.
Have you got your 10 yet?
I've got my 10. I'm just doing... Well, I've actually got 20, but I've got 10 that I've got my eye on, so...
Ooh, exciting. Exciting. Well,
you'll have to wait, John. I think it's the 1st of February it comes out.
I think so, yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, and if it's as good as last year's, then we can expect another happy year on the bargain shares front. I mean, the outperformance last year of AIM, like 20, 25% near enough. No, 23%.
It's well north of 20-odd percent, and... What I say about last year is that I took a specific view on commodity prices as well. So I had Parkmead, which is an explorer in the North Sea. When I recommended that share, cash on the balance sheet and a stake in Ferro Petroleum is a company that I followed quite closely, in effect, backed up 100% its market capitalization, which meant you're getting all its licenses in the price for nothing. And people actually realise, well, hey, those licenses are worth something. And even more so now, because Parkmead's got a crossover with Ferro Petroleum on some of the licenses it holds. And Ferro Petroleum this week succumbed to a bid from DNO, the Norwegian investor in the oil sector, a £600-odd million bid. I don't think the penny's dropped that Parkmead still has a crossover in some of its licences. But the point is that I took a view on the energy price then. I took a view on the commodity prices with Sylvania Platinum. So that's platinum, rhodium, palladium. And as a result of that, I took a view on the dollar as well. And that stock's done incredibly well. It was a diversified portfolio of stocks for that portfolio. And it's going to be the same again, John.
Yeah. Indeed, and those companies you mentioned, Parkmead, Sylvania, two of the best performers in the 10 last year. You've updated on them in the magazine this week.
I've updated on those two. I've also updated on the laggard in the 2018 bargain share portfolio, MPAC, which is a small cap niche packaging engineering business which supplies customers in the pharmaceutical, healthcare and beverage industries with some neat equipment. It's had its problems, but I it had a great trading statement this week, and I think the pennies dropped amongst investors who've bought the shares this week, that things were not as bad as the markets. It goes back to this equity risk premium I'm talking about. So the shares were actually trading below cash in the balance sheets earlier this week, which basically meant a business that's going to make, you know, 1.5 million operating profit this year, forecasted double profit next year off the back of a slew of contracts, that operating business was in the price for nothing. And people have, you know, reassessed the merits of the business this week, and, you know, the stock price has rallied quite a lot. I also looked at an interesting one is Bo Levin, which is another exploration company. It's from the 2016-17 portfolio. It's done very well. Well, when I said buy the shares back in 2016, it's just 19 pence. Cash on the balance sheet was more or less the share price. So again, the implication was that the assets it was actually holding were absolutely worthless, despite the fact it had done a $250 million farm out. Well, this week it's returning 15 pence a share of cash to shareholders, which means if you bought the shares at 19 pence a couple of years ago, you're doing very well, and you still own a stock worth 32 pence.
No, it's good stuff. I think have a read of that, and look forward to the bargain shares in just under a month's time.
A lot of work still to do, but yeah, we're getting there.
Absolutely. Let's talk about retail, which is a sector which is down. But is it out? Before Christmas, the expectation was that that it was going to be an absolute horror show. I think Mike Ashley made a comment before Christmas that the industry was going to get smashed, I think was his exact words. Did it happen?
No. In short, no. I mean, you and I were talking earlier. There are a lot of very almost scaremongering headlines around this week about the worst performance since the last recession, and retail's through the floor and the high street is over. And I think it's important, certainly from a stock picker's point of view at least, to understand that a lot of those headlines have political motivation. We're obviously in uncertain times, particularly around our Brexit negotiations, and a lot of people like to use retail as a sector and the figures within it to illustrate the chaos that they're otherwise trying to quantify.
Yeah, the point being that consumers are feeling so nervous and under financial pressure that they're not spending. And the BRC, the British Retail Consortium, had some figures in December, and they weren't great. No. It was zero growth.
Yeah, zero growth, basically. And depending what you compare it to, sort of month on month or quarter to quarter, they look even worse. So, it's not to take away from those headlines entirely. The backdrop is not fantastic.
One thing I would say is that every December for the last God knows how many years, there has been growth. And now, maybe I'm being a pedant here, but flat sales meet growth means it was the same as last year, which is better than the year before that. And that, so it's not the worst Christmas for 10 years. It's the best.
Yeah.
It's the worst in terms of the amount of growth.
Right. And a lot of people, like I say, the BRC itself will compare quarter to quarter. And a lot of the headlines will pick up on those figures, which tend to be worse. As Simon was saying, we came off what actually turned out to be a relatively good summer for retail. The heat wave sort of inspired people to get out of the house. And depending which retail you're looking at, and depending how reliant they are on weather patterns, a lot of them performed okay. So it was inevitable there was going to be a slowdown. It started in October, and November was a bloodbath, but December really wasn't as bad. A lot of people have used the phrase that Santa came late, and
well, he didn't come until January from what I saw. I mean,
yeah,
actually, because a lot of the trading statements we've seen in the last week have actually extended into the first week of January.
As
January has been pretty good.
January has been great. The momentum that we've seen since the start of the year has been really, really good, illustrated today by B&M. They were ones that particularly saw a real rally towards the end of December. And the date that people have...
It was a revenue warning, wasn't it? It was very strange.
It was not a profit warning. It was a UK like-for-like revenue warning, which was in November, which was in line with what a lot of other retailers experienced, which was a massive slowdown around Black Friday. But they cite the 22nd of December as a real sort of rally point for the entire sector, not just B&M. And that final weekend before the big day itself was sort of a turning point in a lot of ways. And there was a lot more volume growth, which is important, because the other thing the BRC isn't necessarily great at is pointing out the difference between value and volume. Mm-hmm. And obviously we've been in an inflationary environment for prices now for 2 years, so you've got to always be sort of aware of that difference. But yeah, as you say, that momentum has carried on into the new year, and things aren't looking as terrible as people were expecting. I mean, sector by sector, there are still nuances. So supermarkets, for instance, was a big one this week, and there's still quite a lot of doom and gloom in there.
And you've written a news piece on the supermarkets.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, the figures were good.
Figures
people
are good.
Liked them.
And most of the share prices bounced. Tesco came out today, so they didn't make it into the story, but we've written an additional update online for that now. And the overall picture...
Decent like-for-like growth.
Yeah.
I think it was up 2.2%.
Yeah, Tesco was the best performer in the end. But even Sainsbury's, which registered a 0.4% growth in grocery, which was, you know, basically the weakest growth of all four, even their shares rose on the day.
I'm troubled by Sainsbury's, I have to say.
Well, there's a lot going on there. We can get into that.
I'm not convinced by their strategy at the moment, I have to say.
Obviously, they're waiting on a fairly huge merger.
Yeah, I'm not convinced by that at all, the more I think about it.
Which, if I'm honest, I think will happen. I think the CMA will approve it. They're playing hardball at the moment, but they have to, because they appeared to play hardball with Tesco and Booker. Very different deals, but obviously equally kind of grand in scale. But I think eventually, even if disposals are part of it, I think they will wave it through. So Sainsbury's will look like a very different business in terms of its size, at least by the end of the year.
Possibly. Yeah, and obviously not listed, but we've had news from people like Lidl and Aldi, yep, who have had fantastic Christmases.
Waitrose too today.
Waitrose, they were decent Christmas numbers, yep, on the food front.
Yeah,
M&S food numbers were
usual thing,
a little bit, but better than expected.
Yeah, a 2.1% decline like for like, but better than people expected. Again, M&S shares, I mean, all metrics down across the board. Total sales, clothing and home and food, and the shares rose 2% this morning. So
yeah,
it just shows you that it's not as bad as people expected.
The bloodbath never materialised.
Yeah.
Now, if we go back to the cover feature, I mean, we look at... So Dan Liberto's written this. He's put a big screen together of some of the shares that fell most heavily last year. There are a huge number of retailers in there. You've got people like Carpet Riot, Debenhams, Superdry, who else have we got? Dixon's Carphone, McColl's Retail, and then you've got Into Properties, which is obviously a big retail landlord. I thought Ted Baker was in there, but it must have disappeared.
Baker's rallied.
They had a shocker. But actually, we've had some updates, and there's been some really strong performances. I mean, forget M&S, which was kind of pretty poor, but not as poor as expected. Yep. Next numbers were pretty decent.
Next numbers were strong. That propelled, I think, an 8% share price rise on the day.
Yeah.
So that was good. We had Shoezone, which is a buy tip. That was up 10% yesterday, profit upgrade. Greggs has issued 2 profit upgrades in the space of 2 months.
People can't get enough of those vegan sausage rolls.
Yeah, and...
They really can't. They can't make them fast enough.
I mean, that did annoy me yesterday. The flurry of headlines. Vegan sausage roll puts meat in Greggs numbers. Oh God. And also the vegan sausage roll doesn't factor into these figures at all, but we'll just ignore that.
Well, you know, creative license.
Yeah, exactly. Creative inaccuracy. Anyway,
What it does show about Greggs though is that it's an interesting business.
Really?
For years.
Yeah.
One of my theories about the high street is that it is always changing. So I pulled out an old copy from 1994.
Yeah.
Weren't many retailers that you'd recognise on there. M&S was still there.
No, yeah.
Greggs, funnily enough, has been around a long time.
Yeah.
And we tried to imagine what Greggs was selling in 1994, and it wasn't a pleasant thought.
It doesn't bear thinking about, really. But
it's reinvented itself.
Totally.
And it continues to do so.
And it's entirely dependent on the high street, and it's entirely dependent on people visiting shops, which makes it a very interesting business to talk about right now because, you know, if you want to put it alongside food retailers, even the supermarkets are having to think about getting online. And if you put it against the general retailers, then they're definitely online. So that Greggs has been able to carve out its niche so successfully and continue to grow strongly when it is so reliant on physical interaction with customers, you know, it's a testament to how well that business has been able to navigate a very, very changing, in a structural sense, sector.
It's a workplace lunchtime business.
Yeah.
It's a coffee in the morning business.
I was going to say, you know, it doesn't equal trade at breakfast too now, yeah.
Yeah, it is interesting, but it doesn't do that by standing still. It's had to explore new strategies, explore new products, keep up with consumer tastes.
Definitely, and people were counting it out this time last year. It had, give it sort of another couple of months, we'd had, obviously, the Beast from the East last year, if anyone remembers that cold snap. And that did play havoc with their sort of first quarter and into the second. And people were really saying, you know, it's over, they've lost it. And of course that, you know, didn't come to pass. By the end of the third quarter last year, people were saying that was completely overdone. And they'd actually been making a slew of internal investments, which continue, things like centralising their bakery operations and the way they sort of supply all of their high street stores is becoming a lot more streamlined. It's costing them money. So there's no sort of great income on offer or anything with those shares. But the growth on offer is certainly attractive. It's just a shame that whenever the market gets back on board with Greggs, the shares re-rate and the rating becomes impossible to sort of get back on board with. It's always an expensive stock.
Maybe it's one to tuck away when there's a little dip.
Well, it depends how much faith you have in it. But having now covered it for best part of 3 years, I'm certainly starting to have more long-term faith in it and would be willing to go through a couple of shocks, you know, believing that long term they will rally, they will come back.
I mean, we had some numbers from Ted Baker.
Mm.
Now I know that's a company that we both like. The market sort of fell out of love with it a little bit towards the end of last year for non-trading reasons.
I mean, they'd had a pretty poor trading year before that, to be fair. They'd had protracted weakness in Asia, which the market was very nervous about. Any of those companies that sort of border the luxury segment or the aspirational lifestyle segment, as some analysts refer to it, you know, they are dependent on a Chinese consumer. And
the Chinese consumer seems to be battening down the hatches a little bit. I mean,
yeah.
we had obviously some numbers from Apple recently, which were not great, which they very much blamed on a slowdown in Chinese iPhone sales,
mm-hmm.
car sales that we've talked about already.
Yeah, and even Tesco today, most of their weakness is coming out of Asia and Central Europe. So it very much ties into what's going on a macro level as well.
Wealth effect?
Well, if you look at the worst performing markets in 2018, just think emerging markets.
Yeah.
And if you've seen your portfolio collapse, you know, be it Hong Kong shares, Chinese shares, 25-30%, then, yeah, it's going to have an effect on your ability to import into China very expensive BMW with all the import duties. And it's no surprise, really, that I think, was it down 6% or so, the new car sales in China last year?
Yeah, I've got the figure somewhere in that big pile of paper there, which I can't be bothered to look at. But yes, it was maybe 6.8 is ringing a bell.
It was a chunky number.
But the biggest fall for 20 years, I think they said. Or the first fall for 20 years.
It also raises doubts, serious doubts, about the official GDP figures that are actually coming out of China, which
we've never believed them.
Always doubted them, but whether or not there's any growth. Which then raises the possibility of the Chinese government doing yet another massive fiscal boost to the economy.
Which, again, is going to help lift all boats for a while.
A period of time.
So it's funny, isn't it? I mean, it feels like we've been talking about this for years. You know, a weak economy is good news for stock markets because government splurged some cash.
It could very well be the case.
Yeah, well, here we go. I'm sure we're going to see some more weakness this year. But Ted Baker, anyway, sorry, we digress. Edge of luxury theme, not done well, but great numbers over Christmas.
Great numbers over Christmas. And as you referred to, the Ray Kelvin sort of PR scandal at the end of last year seems to not have really touched that performance at all. You know, you get a lot, again, of scaremongering headlines around, you know, there being this sort of feminist boycott of various companies, and it just doesn't seem to materialise.
Yeah, I spent some time with Ted Baker over Christmas and the New Year, and there's no boycott there, I tell you.
No, and you know, it's a testament to the fact that they have grown that brand as much as it was based on supposedly Ray Kelvin's alter ego, and it's very much his business. They've done a fairly good job, I think, of managing to actually separate him from it to the sort of untrained eye, as it were. So a lot of their loyal customers are probably quite unaware of that particular tie, and they just see the product for what it is, which is good quality at a price point which they can afford. So
my kids were blissfully unaware. They're big fans of Ted Baker, blissfully unaware of any scandals going on, and that's continues to be what they want for Christmas. So doesn't really affect anything, I would say. So what we're saying here is that actually some of the numbers from the retail sector have been pretty decent. It wasn't the basket case that perhaps it was expected to be over Christmas. Even Debenhams.
No, well,
did it do quite as badly? Isn't looking quite as awful?
I'm still going to say it's terrible. John, it's terrible. You can read Dan Liberto's sort of mild defence, although I think
it's very measured. I would say.
I think he comes ultimately to my conclusion as well, which is that it's in pretty dire straits. To be honest,
it's the fourth biggest fall of the year.
Yeah,
94%.
I put it onto a mini sell this time last year. We put it through official sell through Tips of the Week around May, June time. So that's when we start sort of officially tracking the progress. So even in the last 6 months of last year, it's down 70% on my sell tips. So yeah, it's been an absolute shocker. And today their Christmas trading was pretty appalling. And they have now also said that they need to refinance all of their banking facilities within the next 12 months. And they're in constructive discussions with their lenders, which is really interesting because shortly before Christmas, Mike Ashley, who people may be aware of, has a 30% stake via Sports Direct in Debenhams, had supposedly the Telegraph published this letter, which Mike Ashley had supposedly sent to the board at Debenhams, offering them a £40 million emergency injection, basically, to which they said no. And he wrote this scathing letter, as you can imagine, from our good friend Mike Ashley, basically telling them what a mistake that was and that their days were numbered. And so a funding crisis is no surprise.
Having said that, they were pursuing a programme of asset sales, which they appear to have put on hold.
They have to put them on hold.
So this isn't because they don't need the money, it's because they can't sell
them.
Right, fine.
I don't know the ins and outs of the regulation off the top of my head, but because they are now in formal discussions with their lenders, they cannot do asset disposals at the same time.
Where does that leave their credit insurers for their supplies?
Yeah, I mean, it looks bad. And, House of Fraser should be good case study for us in this sense. We watched it play out, or the worst case scenario for suppliers play out last summer, which was, I think, at one point Mike Ashley, having bought it out of administration, was only honouring something like 3p for every pound to suppliers. It could be real crisis time for them.
They were really giving away stock. I took advantage before Christmas, and a certain brand of shoes made its way into my Christmas stocking.
About 10 pairs. Shoes for life.
You've noticed. At a 55% discount to the full retail price, which was unheard of for Lokes. And also things like Paddy Wax candles. I'd recommend Vertiver and Cardamom if you ever like those smells. However,
when you're having your evening bath, John.
Yeah, that's what I do in the evenings.
You know, at 40% discounts.
Yeah.
And again, that's
desperate.
Yeah.
Just need to get the cash coming.
And it's, you know, great for the consumer.
Yeah.
Free postage as well. Great. Where's the margin?
You had an interesting experience in House of Fraser, though, didn't you?
Well, I popped into the one at Monument just before Christmas because it's closing down.
Yes.
Because they wouldn't renegotiate their lease.
It was already slated to close before the administration, but yeah.
You know, I thought I'd pop in and see what bargains I could discover, and there weren't any, basically. It appeared that Sports Direct had taken out anything good, which I assume it will sell through some of its other brands.
Yeah, through Flannels, I think, which is their sort of designer store, which the new one is due to open on Oxford Street any day now, I think.
Okay, but all I could find in there was the stuff that you could find in any Common and Garden Sports Direct, Lee Cooper sweatshirts and such like.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was quite a tragic thing to witness.
Yeah. Well, it is a fall from grace. I mean, it would be interesting to see how this year plays out in terms of that House of Fraser transformation, what they'll be able to do with it, because of course there is massive read across for Debenhams, because what they both have in common is Mike Ashley.
But you're saying Debenhams is pretty much toast. That's your
view. I mean, the problem with Debenhams is that obviously it targets a slightly less affluent, well, not even slightly, a less affluent customer base than House of Fraser. And as our feature just before Christmas sort of pointed out, it's really that sort of upper premium lifestyle luxury.
Simon just said he shopped there.
At Debenhams?
For my low shoes.
Well, yeah, I mean, no comment. I've totally lost my train of thought.
It doesn't matter. Debenhams is toast, I think we're saying.
Yeah.
And there's probably going to be some.
It's just not as a defensive business. And, you know, how well their shareholders are going to react to a CVA at this point. I mean, yeah, it's going to be carnage.
And to be fair to Dan, I mean, the feature is about how you go about the process of looking at a share that's fallen mm-hmm. heavily and working out whether it's been oversold. He does conclude his piece on Debenhams by saying that it has some interesting ideas, but none strong enough to guarantee its presence on the UK high streets for years to come.
Yeah, absolutely. He doesn't. So, he's not exactly recommending a recovery play.
But he has a couple of other ideas there, which do look a little bit more interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I think if we want to sort of round up what we're saying about retail, the thing that you and I think often agree on is the fact that the retailers which have performed well over Christmas and saved it from being a complete bloodbath are the ones that have been able to keep up with the times and reinvent themselves, get online, whatever that may be, streamline their distribution.
Or not online.
Lidl's
not online, and it's doing extremely well.
Know what they do well. You know, there's another angle to that. Greggs is a good example of that too. But the ones that have failed to keep up with their consumer or their customers' changing demands and changing tastes and behaviours, they're the ones that are, you know, crashing out. And so it's really, in a lot of ways, there are no surprises here. It's just about understanding individually what companies have done and what they haven't.
I just think it's kind of hyperbole to suggest that the UK high street retail is dead. And that's the pretty much the gist of the headlines we see. I've even seen reports that suggest it will cease to exist entirely in 50 years' time. But people do like going shopping. It is a leisure activity.
Yeah.
Go to Westfield Stratford. Go to the biggest shopping centre, urban shopping centre in Europe, Westfield Shepherd's Bush or White City, I think it is. Mm-hmm. Go to Lakeside. Drive for miles to get there and queue for ages to find a parking spot. People are mad for it.
Yeah, I mean, and certainly, I think we live obviously in a bit of a London bubble with these things sometimes as well, where we sort of see a very metropolitan existence day to day.
Where we're giving up stuff because we have to live in tiny flats.
Yeah, and also that we want things, you know, we're all at work all day and no one's at the house, so we get stuff delivered and we're all much more online. But, you know, you forget there's a big ish country out there that doesn't live like that, and they do still do a lot of things in their communities and in their town centres. It's interesting what you say about the government, you know, spending more on, you know, when markets are weak, because in the autumn budget we had a lot of sort of rhetoric from Philip Hammond around reinvesting in town centres and pledging all sorts of money, which until business rates really get addressed I don't think will make that much difference, but to take, you know, not to take the sentiment away, you know, his pledge was that he wants to see town centres become a focus of communities again and of people's day-to-day lives. So,
well, let's hope it happens. Let's hope it happens. Anyway, so yeah, lots of opportunities in retail, really.
I think
sell-off has delivered us some potential bargains there. I presume there's not much retail in the bargain shares portfolio, however.
Could be
really
one company.
Oh my goodness!
Oh, I bet it's your favourite.
Oh, let's not speculate. I don't know what that is. That's quite interesting, though.
I haven't looked at retail stocks for some time. I put French Connection into the portfolio about 3 years ago, and it is possibly being taken over. It's still being courted by who knows at the moment. So it's going through that official bid process. This stock is basically where it was a couple of years ago. So, you know, it hasn't done anything, but there could be one, John.
I await with bated breath. I think that's all we've got time for. Thank you, Harriet, and thank you, Simon. There's lots more in the magazine this week, apart from retail. We've got lots of comments. Chris looking at diversification. We have No Free Lunch, Paul Jackson looking at buybacks. This is really quite interesting. Buybacks being a big feature of the US market, something that's often been pointed to as part of the reason why it's rallied so strongly over the last few years, and whether this will happen in the UK to the same extent. Phil Oakley's back this week. He's looking at so-called bond proxies, so sort of big, safe shares. Like Unilever, seeing whether they're, I think as we put it on the cover, a share for all seasons or lumbering giants under threat. John Barron's in this week with a 10-year anniversary roundup of his investment trust portfolios. All the usual tips, very few results, which will remain the case for a few weeks longer, thank goodness. We're looking at the mining activity around fertilisers. Alex Newman's put that together. And Algie's rounded up his stock screens from the past year. And the big thing there is that value appears to be making a comeback. Not Simon, that it ever went away when it comes to the bargain shares portfolio.
Stock pickers always will be around.
Absolutely. Anyway, thank you, Simon. Thank you, Harriet. And thank you all for listening. Pick up the magazine in all good news agents, Down But Not Out, How to Spot Struggling Shares Ready for a Jump Start. And we'll be back again next week. Thank you.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.